So it's great to be at Future Decoded. And, thanks for coming along. And I'm going to be talking about sort of really part of the journey for F-Sharp over the last couple of years in two directions, both of which I find incredibly exciting and in a sense relieving, sort of fleshing out the picture for F-Sharp. Started as a research language, moved through into this sort of Visual Studio kind of era back in 2008, 2010, 2011, you know, where F-Sharp was in Visual Studio, Visual F-Sharp was F-Sharp, and sort of mutually locked together at the hip, you know. And now we've kind of got very new and exciting directions that in many ways make F-Sharp a much more normal language in the industry. We have a fabulous community story around F-Sharp, and I'm going to be talking to you about that. And we've also got a fabulous scalable and sort of distributed cloud programming story emerging for F-Sharp as well. Both of those are things which, in a sense, were missing in the early era of the language. We had a great community, but it wasn't a community that was sort of owning and empowered with the direction of the language. And we were always, I think, missing a really good scalable cloud distributed programming story for the language. We had to rely on sort of Microsoft technologies like WCF, for example, not a framework I'm particularly fond of myself. But now we're seeing this sort of homegrown technologies really solving these issues for F-Sharp. And part of the background is the world is kind of changing a lot from the days where programmability at Microsoft was about Windows. Programmability in the industry now means all these different themes are coming in, and they're flooding through the Microsoft, or the sort of the languages that originate from Microsoft, and we're having to come to terms with all these kind of things that are driving us to rethink what languages are and what they mean. So, you know, I'm the original designer of the F-Sharp programming language, and so of course a core question for me is, you know, what kind of language design do we need to cope with the era of the cloud or the web, for example? So, for example, I work on, say, asynchronous programming, which we've seen come through into F-Sharp and C-Sharp, and, you know, that's a core language design issue. But I've come to realize that just as important is what kind of language community, what kind of culture do you have associated with your language? Is it a community and a culture that embrace openness, that embrace cross-platform? Is it a community and culture that embrace innovation and ideas and creativity? Is it a community that's empowered, where the people using the language can make tools and own their own destiny as to what, as to the tooling stacks they sit on? And also, what kind of language technologies do you have upstack? What are your web frameworks? What are your data frameworks? What are your cloud programming frameworks? These aspects are just as important as the language design. We have language culture and language tech. And it's very important in a language that we get sort of equal balance, equal weight between these three kind of domains. So I want to talk a little bit about the F-Sharp community and why I absolutely love being a contributor to that community. So just to give you the too long didn't read, F-Sharp itself is open, cross-platform, neutral, and independent. Okay, when we talk about what Microsoft make, we talk about the Visual F-Sharp tools, the F-Sharp tools for Visual Studio, and other contributions which are uniquely things that really only Microsoft can do and that are in Microsoft's business interests to do that. The F-Sharp language is accepting contributions. I'll be talking about that in a bit. And there's a wonderful foundation associated with F-Sharp. Let me resurrect my browsing session. So we have let's check we're all up and running again. Here we are, the F-Sharp Software Foundation, which is the sort of community advocacy organization associated with the F-Sharp language. It has a great mission around education and spreading and protecting and preserving the F-Sharp language. So on the tooling side, we have Xamarin providing F-sharp tooling for Android and iOS. I'm not going to be talking about that today. I think it'd be fantastic just to have a whole talk at an event like that about this tooling, how you can use F-sharp in conjunction with the Xamarin tooling to write Android and iOS apps. The Visual F-sharp tools are Microsoft's professional tools for F-sharp programming. Obviously, they are going to focus on the platforms Microsoft really care about, and that's the Windows platform, the Azure platform, for the purposes of this discussion. And I think it's in order to understand Microsoft's relationship to these programming languages, which were originally created either in Microsoft Research or C-sharp at Microsoft, I think it's really crucial to understand what are Microsoft's interests. What is Microsoft going to do for those languages? And what do you have to do for those languages? You being the broader, the whole broad ecosystem. Microsoft contribute to these languages for their own business interests, okay? And you, as users of these languages, it's absolutely critical that you become contributors to these languages as well, looking after your interests, both as individual programmers, as a programming community. And I am a strong believer that the F-sharp community needs to own its own destiny, in a sense, and that the C-sharp community also need to begin to start to adopt that mindset and understand that Microsoft have certain interests, but there are all sorts of other people who have interests in C-sharp as well. We have right across the industry, we need to be looking at C-sharp and F-sharp as being multi-contributor kind of technologies. So we have, in terms of the packagings of F-sharp, we have these fabulous Debian packages, Docker containers, and more for the Linux ecosystem, as you'd expect for any normal language in the industry. And sort of the infrastructure level, we have the F-sharp compiler service. It's that's the component that powers this sort of spread of F-sharp into lots of different editors in particular. I'll give you a flavor for what those look like. Compiler service, here it is on GitHub. This is kind of like the Roslyn for F-sharp. It's a single DLL. Called F-sharp compiler service.dll. And you can take a look at what's available in it for the sort of all the different language editing. It's got, you can host the F-sharp compiler, host F-sharp interactive, and you can kind of see the sorts of things that people build with it. Emacs, Vim, tooling for F-sharp. We've got some great editing projects. If you're into the Atom editor, there's an F-sharp plugin called Ionide for the Atom editor. This is booming along as a project. Lots of contributors to this, and if you're interested in getting in and contributing to an editing level experience for F-sharp, this is a great one to contribute to. And this is built using the F-sharp compiler service running as a service on your local machine as part of the Ionide package. Okay, so as I said, the F-sharp community is very self-empowered, owning their own tooling destiny. I'll be talking about that in a number of different aspects. And what all this kind of picture means, as far as I'm concerned as a language designer, is that I get to focus back on what I uniquely can contribute to F-sharp, which is looking after the core language design issues and also the working on the cloud programming story, the two parts I'm talking about today. This sort of shift, this spreading of F-sharp into lots of different editors, lots of cross-platform kind of working, and allowing contributions to come in has allowed me to go on and focus back on F-sharp 4.0, and in conjunction with a lot of people in the F-sharp community, deliver F-sharp 4.0 through to the community. So just to give a couple of examples of how people are actually using F-sharp in practice and industry, this is a quote from Simon Cousins. So it's about an application in a UK power company about deciding whether to turn the power stations on or not, based on market signals coming in. These are the sort of things that he liked about F-sharp. We've got interoperation, strong typing, exploratory programming, the way functional code tends to be highly unit testable, parallelism, code reduction, and sort of this lack of bugs that a lot of F-sharp programmers report through their use of the language. So in summary, we like to summarize these up to these high-level themes. So one is time to market. How long does it take you to get your ideas into practice and into realization in terms of code? How long does it take to get correct code? Is that code efficient? Okay, we're talking strongly typed, very high-performant .NET code, and those three high-level themes. Just Simon did an analysis of another parallel project in his company. Now, this was using a very object-oriented methodology versus what we'd think of as a functional-first methodology with F#. And you can read about this comparison. It's not just a difference in language. It's also a difference in methodology between these two. It's sort of C-sharp, probably C-sharp 2.0 era programming, perhaps. Maybe a bit of C-sharp 3.0. And he's got a blog post called "Does the Language You Use Make a Difference?" I think he's changed the title to say "Does the Methodology You Use Make a Difference?" And he's being a bit more finessed about that point. But you can see some of the big differences there in terms of code base size and the number of developers and so on the project. F# tends to be extremely good for this cranking out correct solutions to this kind of problem. He's also adamant that F# is a safe choice for his company out because he's had several systems where he's deployed them into practice, zero bugs. He's had to ring up the operations center to check that the thing is actually being run because he usually waits for bug reports to find out that things are being deployed. And again, you can read about that on his blog. Here's some stats here. 56,000 lines of braces in the C# code there versus not so much in the F# code. You can check the blanks and the null checks. You see F# without having, since null is not a default in F#, then you have far fewer null checks than necessary in your code. And you can see through there's healthy numbers of tests in the F# code. We don't skimp on things like testing. Okay, perhaps the statistic from that particular comparison which interests me the most is this one. This is the number of try-catch statements in the C# code versus the F# code. Now, something was clearly going wrong in this C# project. It was an event-driven system, and I think written in the days before C# async, and I think effectively they started to get exceptions happening in event handlers. They didn't know where to send those exceptions, so they pretty much every bit of code they started to check into the system had to be covered in a try-catch statement. In the F# code, it operated differently, and they didn't need anywhere near as much of that explicit exception handling in the code. But this was clearly a C# code base that it kind of got out of control in terms of its complexity. Just one other example of how F# is being used. This is F# for social gaming. This is for a very popular Facebook server-side implementation of Facebook games. And you can contact Yang Kui to get more details about that. These testimonials are available on the F# org, F# Software Foundation site that I showed before. Okay, right. So yeah, it's been 18 months since we adopted what I think of as a highly community-friendly approach to the F# language. And I think we've come a really long way during this time. We've got loads of pull requests to the core F# compiler and language. You can, to contribute, you just go along to the main repository where contributions flow into, Microsoft Visual F#. We have a language design process. You can read about it on fslang.uservoice.com. You can add suggestions to the language design. And ultimately, I'm the one who takes those and synthesizes those and works out what we're going to put into practice as additions of the language roll out. We've rolled out F# 4.0. First of all, it's a big cultural shift here to cross-platform and open engineering. Lots of little language items that we looked after. We did this great normalization of the core library to really beef up the set of functions that are available across all of F#.core, and we did a set of features to make the type provider feature in F# more powerful, giving and work on compiler perf and some other things. One of the great things that has happened in the F# community is this project, the Visual F# Power Tools. Okay, so tooling in F# in Visual F# back in the 2010 era was definitely thin, very thin. And with the Visual F# Power Tools, you get a really good range of of tooling here, rename, refactoring, and highlight references, and the syntax coloring options, and so on. You can see the full list there. So I'd encourage you, if you're using Visual Studio, go and install the Visual F# Power Tools, and it's fully open source, and you can fully contribute to this project as well. There's a lot of activity going on, new features being added, and really good refinements and performance improvements on the existing feature set. And I mentioned F# for Android, iOS, Linux, and Mac. If you want to get started with any of those, just go along to fsharp.org, follow the links, F# use on Android, iOS, Linux, Mac. You can go and get started with app development for Android and iOS today, for example. Okay, so that's at the core of the F# world. And one thing I want to emphasize is embracing openness and embracing sort of community empowerment extends to the whole language, to the whole community. And one of the things that's come out of that is a fabulous web development stack for F#. Well, it's not even a stack, it's really just a library. It's simple, it's clear, the code is just straight F# code, and it just makes server-side web programming just the simple, clear, declarative programming that it deserves to be. So I like Suave a lot. Suave.io is the place to find out more about this. Again, fully open source, community-driven, and you can contribute to this and being deployed in production by quite a number of places now. So where possible, the F# community take a collaborative approach to .NET technologies generally. If you take a .NET technology like math.NET, the F# community are very active in using that technology. It's designed in a way to be friendly across both C# and F#, and it's getting used by sort of both communities heavily. Another place where we see that sort of win-win coming through is in ACTA.NET, okay, an ACTA programming model based on the ACTA design that's very popular in Java and Scala, bringing across those design idioms and allowing you to switch between, say, ACTA with Java Scala or ACTA with F# C#. And it comes with an F# API as well. You can also just use the .NET API directly from F#, though there are some things, it's being used actively by F# developers. And I'd encourage you, if you're interested in sort of heterogeneous ACTA programming for distributed and concurrent applications, then this is a great place for .NET developers to be coming and joining together to make a very powerful technology. Okay, I talked a lot about how the F# community owns its own destiny in terms of tooling in different ways. You saw that in the Visual F# Power Tools, and Microsoft are big contributors to those things as well. One tool that's getting a lot of people interested. Is Packet. Packet is like a replacement for NuGet.exe on your client side for managing your dependencies within your projects, be they C# projects or F# projects. And so it's not F# specific, though it is implemented in F#. It just happens to be implemented in F#. That's not, you can use it for your C# projects as well. So a lot of NuGet v3 is influenced by Packet, though I still think Packet plays an important role in a number of different ways, even with NuGet v3 coming out. So it's one particular thing is that it's just useful to understand how things can be done a bit differently and a bit more cleanly over in the Packet world. So I'm a big fan of that, and it's used in a lot of F# community projects, but also in C# projects as well. Another bit of build and test tooling is Fake. F# Make is where they use F# as the scripting language for build tasks and for build automation, and you can go through and automate your entire build and deploy stack using 200 lines of F# code in Fake. So again, an excellent tool to allow you to kind of, you have those thousands and thousands of lines of MS build projects. You still have your core project files, but Fake really cleans up the rest of the sort of explosion of XML that can happen. You can get rid of most of your build projects and simplify your world considerably using Fake. And I'll be talking a bit about Embrace, the cloud programming technology. We'll talk about that in the last part of the talk, which is, again, 100% open source and community-driven cloud and distribution programming framework for F#. We have Docker images. You can take a look at the official ones at hub.docker.com, F#. And F# for Core CLR, yes, we have that. Here's a short snippet on compiling up F# code using the early versions of F# running and compiling on the Core CLR here. Okay, and finally, the last part of the kind of community spectrum, again, this is a unique Microsoft contribution to the F# community, is about F# for Windows 10 and UWP apps. And that has now been approved. The official status on that is now working on it. And you can take a look at the WinDev user voice discussion on that. And that's, you know, really good thing to see that starting to come down through the pipeline. Okay. So in the next part of the talk, I just want to touch on what is probably my favorite F# feature at the moment. It's an application of the more general feature called F# type providers, which allow you to have these adding components which compute these type spaces that augment your F# programming. But it's one particular way of using type providers, which is about drawing types directly from data. So I want to do that just by showing a couple of samples of F# code. Let's come across here. Okay, so let's take a look here, and first I'll just do some standard F# interactive scripting. Here's where we create a table of data here, and here's where we display it on a grid. I've opened an F# script, I've opened F# interactive below, and I'm highlighting parts of code and sending them to F# interactive and evaluating them. This kind of mode of use of F# is very common in the sort of data scripting kind of work, and has particular, this scripted mode works extremely well with F# type providers, as we'll see in just a moment. So we're creating some more data, and we might pop up some other display forms here, and we might take some sort of output of the. So we're tracking the events on the form behind and building up a data set and visualizing it in the window below. So we have events flowing in through the top window and then sort of an output data set coming in below. Okay, or we might do a slightly more incremental version of that here, which is where we're building up a data set incrementally down here. Okay. Right, so let's close those down. Okay, so here we reference the F# data type provider here. So F#.data is, again, a community project for using F# type providers and providing a data experience with all of the major data formats in the industry today, be it CSV data, comma separated value data, XML data, JSON data, and other data formats, MATLAB, SAS, and so on. Okay, so in the types from data work, the philosophy is very simple. You come along and you let's say you've got something important. I'm sure you all walked into the venue today and you saw that the Doctor Who conference is on. I'm not sure what they call it. It's a Dalek. It's called Daleks or something. It's called. It's on in 2 days here, and I'm sure you're all coming, okay? And now you need data, okay? So the types from data kind of point of view is, here is data. We have tables and tables and tables of data. It happens to be on Wikipedia, but it's an HTML table, okay? Why can't we just have this as if it were a library in our code? Why can't we just reference data and use it? And in a strongly typed way, So our language, you know, the strong typing in our languages understands this stuff directly. And that's the essential theme. Now, you might not just have data. You might also just have samples of data. So this might be this is a unique individual data source. But in many cases, the same principle applies. We've got some sample of JSON data, and we know that that's a sample from the stream of data that's coming from a web service. Or we have some sample of XML data, and we've got 50 gigabytes of the same kind of data with the same kind of shape on our machine. So why do I have to write out the schema explicitly when I've already got a sample? Okay, so in the types from data work, well, that's sort of what you do. You take the URL here, and since we're a little bit short on time, I'll just use what I've typed already. You type in HTML provider, point it at the URL, and you've got a typed projection of that web page directly into your programming language. Okay, so then you instantiate an instance of that and take a look at that web page. Okay, so you can get the raw HTML, but you can also look at the lists and tables on that page. And there are the tables. We have that data directly, directly in our programming language. So you might be interested in a particular season here. You can see, and there's some, and all the specials of Doctor Who down here, so on. Okay, but let's say we're interested in the overview here, and we might be interested in the rows. Generate row dot. Okay, so now we're going to look through the rows of that table, and again, we're in a strongly typed world. I haven't had to do anything. This is, you know, the ultimate screen scraping experience, okay, that we can just come along and we can see exactly what columns are available in that table. So, for example, we might be interested in which doctors are acting were in that particular season and how many viewers that season had. Okay, so let's do that here. So, for example, we can work out here the different elements being held in the doctors column, or we might take a look at what's in the originally aired column here. And then we take the data, similar to the kind of programming we are doing above with charting, we can take that data, we can slice it, dice it, you know, compute on it, visualize it, serve it up through Suave, prototype a Suave website using this site. You can just reference Suave as another DLL in this kind of programming, prototype the delivery of this as mashed up web content, mash it up with other data sources, all at the same time staying in your zone as an F# data scripter, pulling and doing the same thing with as many other data sources as you can into the same script with the same sort of joint mashup data programming experience. Okay, so from this, you obviously decide you want to come along as the most popular doctor, so that'll be this one, the ninth doctor here, if anybody's wanting to know who was most popular. Okay, now that same idea of types from data can be used in many other settings. If you have a sample of JSON data here, you can give it to the JSON provider. The JSON data is enough to say, okay, well, we've worked out the obvious types based on that data, and now you can go ahead and use that to parse other instances of that data. So we have some JSON data here. And you might say that sounds a bit contrived, but that means you can just take F# here, point it at a web API. So say, for example, whoa, there's a lot of JSON data. That would take quite a long time to build up a strongly typed programming model to work over that JSON data, parse it into your types. I mean, I've seen projects where at least half the project is just defining the object model and getting your JSON data into that strongly typed object model. I mean, the F# programmer doesn't even need to think about that sort of thing. You just point it at the sample, and it works out the types from there. So let's define that now, just to prove that we have strong typing here. That is all the different fields available in the different issues on GitHub. Here we're analyzing the issues on the Core CLR site, and you can see all the different kinds of data elements that you can pull out. So you can compute over that data and get the top ranked types, and you want to know which issues have just been recently updated on the Core CLR site. You can see them analyzed there. So if part of your work is to sit on JSON or XML or CSV data and do stuff with it, then F#.data is a fabulous library to be working with. Just to say, you can do it with XML. I won't go through the sample here, but you get the general idea. Okay, so in the last part of the talk, I want to be talking, we've gone from F# community and F# for data. I want to be talking about F# for cloud programming. And I'd just like first to invite up Isaac Abraham, who's going to be talking about on this with me. Isaac, before, you've got a mic? Yeah, okay, great. Tell me first, take a few moments to say how you got into F# and why you think it's the right thing for the cloud.
Yeah, so I've been using F# for about 3 or 4 years now. I've been C# dev since since .NET 1.0. F# for me, I spend a lot of time in Azure as well, in the cloud. It's simply a very simple language. I can write code and get my data much more quickly. And as Don's already said, you simply get much less bugs. Our time to market for products and solutions for customers is just way quicker.
Okay, great. Okay, so I'm just going to run through a little bit about cloud language design, and then Isaac's going to give us some demos of using Embrace in this sort of this data scripting, but a cloud data scripting kind of mode. So on the language design side of things, when you kind of think, what are the elements that really matter in a language for cloud programming? And the things that stand out to me for F#, first of all, it's functional. You can just see already the way that data, and in a sense, immutable data, and transformations of data, and piping of data, it goes absolutely through the cloud and web and web API kind of programming world. Second, it has this scripting experience. And to me, the cloud is something you need to, when you're thinking of scaling out an algorithm, a lot of it is investigatory. You've got to play with things. You've got to test. You've got to get a feel. How fast are those virtual machines in the cloud? How fast are my network connections? How much does my data sort of weigh, okay, because its data begins to have a weight in a way it doesn't have on the local machine. And so the scripting and interactive and explorative modes actually are very important part of the programming language. Then you have language features like async, which are just essential for scaling up certain kinds of operations while keeping the structure of your code correct. And you can see the role that type providers has in, we were sitting on a JSON feed there, which looks terribly untyped, but we were getting a fully strongly typed experience based on a sample of that data. Now, it's true the sample might change, the endpoint might change. Those you have to think about those things and work out what you're picking up dependencies on. But the core experience is data through to strongly typed consumption and transformation and republication of that data. So the core idea of the Embrace framework is to take the idea of how async acts as a kind of modality, a mode in your code. When you have async code, it's kind of separated out from non-async code, from synchronous code, by the type system in languages like F# and C#. And to apply that same idea to cloud programming. So you'll see in Embrace, you'll see this cloud curly. It's kind of the core idea of the Embrace framework. And the great thing about these cloud curly blocks, first of all, they're type separated, so you kind of know when you're doing cloud programming. But secondly, these babies are distribution ready. Okay, it's an indicator that they might be serialized, transported to other machines. Any dependencies that they have in terms of DLLs are automatically and seamless, and data dependencies automatically transported to the appropriate workers in your Azure cluster. So these obviously don't use shared memory, and they ultimately map down to various kinds of cloud tasks and cloud worker items. So let's take a look at Embrace here. So first of all, the website, embrace.io. And if you want to get started, you follow through down this lovely one. You can use Embrace without using Azure. The Embrace programming model is, in fact, independent of Azure. And there's work going on as we speak to map Embrace to Amazon Web Services and to other fabrics as well, which is actually also an interesting part in the spectrum. Do you want a sort of vendor-neutral kind of cloud programming experience. So you can use Embrace in a locally simulated cluster on your local machine. That's embrace.core. And you can also use the same, exactly the same programming model where the code is run in a service in Azure. Okay, so to go and create your service, you come through here. The current creation experience is just to run a single line of code, and that will create your cluster in Azure and return you the connection strings to that cluster. You just download your publication settings file, execute that single line of F# code. About 4 minutes later, you have your fully running cluster. You can say how many say what size of VMs you want. You can say what data center you want them to be in, and you can say how many virtual machines you want running in your cluster. That creates the storage account and the queuing services that are required to as part of the cluster. Okay, so when you do that, after you do that, you'll have in your management console here, you'll see a cloud service will appear. Okay, so take a look at those here. You can see this Embrace cluster here. You can manage and configure and scale that cloud service. This one's currently running with, I think, 8 machines. If you want to scale it up to 100 machines, you just modify the setting under the scale, and a few minutes later, it'll be adapted up to here.
Make sure your credit card limit is high enough for that, though.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Once you've done that, you can open up the Embrace starter kit here, and you're ready to run your first Embrace samples. So this connects to the cluster based on your configuration strings that your creation returned, and you now have a connection to Azure from your local machine. You can expect, for example, the workers you have in your cluster. So the experience here is very much like your Azure cluster is like a co-processor to your F# data scripting. Okay? You've got to imagine, you've seen some F# data scripting already, and you've got to say, imagine you're at the point where you say, ooh, that's going to take quite a long time. I want to scale that out over 24 machines. So you just do it without leaving. You create your create your machines directly from your F# data scripting. You as a programmer are just augmented with this massive, scalable collection of resources. You don't do this local emulation and then deploy to cloud and sort of debug on cloud and everything like that. You just stay in your F# data scripting and stay in your zone and just have the cloud as your compute and data slave. Okay, so you want to run your first cluster, your first bit of cloud code here. This is how you do it. You just take your code, in this case returning Hello World, you put it in Cloud Curly, you send it to the cluster, and that's it. Okay, that's how you as an F# data scripter now use any Embrace installation. The same experience will be true on any other mappings of Embrace. You can see some logging that's come out down below about posting it to some queue and all the, and adding any data dependencies that are there. Now, if this code here uses any C# DLLs or uses any F# DLLs, they will automatically be transported to the cluster for you, okay, incrementally, in the sense that it won't do it again every time you run it. Okay, it'll amortize that transport. And if you use some data, if I define some data here, so let's say I define, just say the numbers from 1 to 100,000 in here, and I do data.length or something in here, plus that, and I return that to a string, something like that, then that data would actually be transported up as part of the cloud job. Now, that data doesn't have to be constant data. This could be some read local file in here. So the results of reading the local file will be transported up into the cloud. And that seamless transport of code and data is absolutely beautiful in the Embrace experience. You can transport native DLLs up as well. That if they're 64-bit DLLs, this is running 64-bit here, running 64-bit in the cloud. So you can just register native dependencies and they will go up as well. So if you've got some really high performance C++ components old Fortran code you want to parallelize, you can just transport that up as part of your work. Okay, so we ran a task, and not surprisingly, that task has completed. It wasn't doing a lot, and we get the result here, task. You can see the various things you can look at on the task here. You can do it all in one step, if you like, on cluster.run over here. So in that time there, it has sent work to the code, to the Azure queues. The workers I've got have picked it up and run it, collected the results and put them back, and then we've awaited the result back on our local machine. Okay, now the Embrace Starter Kit goes through and covers how you do parallel composition of your code, how you do scale out of CPU intensive code. It covers how you can use C# and native components in the cloud, and gives some examples of doing a distributed matrix computation using Embrace. It also covers the data primitives of Embrace. Embrace isn't just a compute system, it's also a data system. So that it's using the Azure storage as a big file system. It's also storage of temporary values and in a partitioned way. And the last thing it covers is how to do this data parallel programming model to draw on data or incremental streams of data and do processing over those in your cluster. So if we take a look at that, then the overall programming model is really lean and it's really simple. We have this cluster, we have cloud blocks, we have local, we have cloud parallel for composition. We have this job control, creating a process, running a process, getting a process, killing a process. We have some data primitives, cloud value, cloud file, and cloud queue. There's also cloud dictionary for key value stores. And finally, we have this data flow, parallel, compositional cloud parallel data flow model. The code, one thing I really love about Embrace is that the code is simple. Okay. And let's just talk at the last part about this cloud flow model, and then Isaac will do the final demo. Just to say that this is what the code looks like down the left, and this is what you're actually doing in the Azure cluster. You do off cloud file by line, drawing from these partition files, you're doing maps and you're doing some kind of reduction. Your functions are being run over these in this sort of over your workers, and then you might persist it. And you might do other things like take HTTP as input, you might take queues as input and queues as output to get incremental processing. You might take your local data as arrays and adjust that. Now, in the last 2 minutes, we'll take a look at the... Isaac will take over and talk about this data parallel programming example we have here. And I'm aware we're kind of short on time, so I'll just whack these in and get this started for Isaac while he talks. Okay, over to you.
So this is basically the cloud flow, which Don just mentioned, is this sort of distributed data flow. So what we're doing is essentially some analysis on house prices that we've sourced from a publicly available website, the UK Gov house prices. So essentially you can see we have a URL there called sources. That's basically a path to a CSV file, plain CSV. When we move down a bit and look at this computation we're doing underneath it, excuse me, we're basically saying read this HTTP file by line and distribute that file across our cluster. So we've got 4 machines or 8 machines. The lines will be partitioned across them. Then we're pushing that into a type provider. So the same sort of type provider you saw earlier on for HTML, we've got one for CSV. So we're automatically converting our lines into a strongly typed data set. And then underneath that, we're going to say average those prices, the prices by year and month. So essentially there, if we dot into, for example, row, we'll see that we get a fully strongly typed data set here. We don't have to worry about parsing, things like you would do with Hive with Metastore or with Hadoop or Pig. Don't have to do any of that there. We're just plugging in these type providers seamlessly. And then we're saying group up by year and month, average by price, sort by the first 100 rows, and then execute that code. That's it. There's no parsing of data required. We don't have to worry about dealing with the reconstitution of the data or anything like that. We can see the job's done. We can get the results there. And then we can just simply chart it. So 15 lines of code, and we've straight away got some analysis of data. And that is thus scalable. We could do that over gigs or terabytes of data. even better than that, we can even persist computations across a cluster. So if we have a computation, for example, that we want to do multiple calculations on, we can say we'll do a first part of this computation and then persist that in memory across the cluster. And then we can reuse that computation multiple times. So that where that storage level.memory is, that's basically saying just put it into memory rather than spilling it out onto disk. This is something you might have heard with Spark, which has a notion of an RDD. This is very similar to that. So here we're going to do another one, which basically gets average prices by town and district and street, which is itself going to be built off an existing Cloudflow that we've already done. Once we've got that, again, we can wait for the result. And then we can do any number of calculations from that. And you can see in the interactive, from if you just go back up again, you'll see there you've got this 8 nodes. And we'll see that the data set has actually been partitioned across all of those 8 machines. So we've got 25,000 rows, for example, across each node. There you can see them.
Yeah.
That's all happened for us. We don't have to worry about that. Embrace will see how many nodes we've got and partition it for us. Finally, we're going to do a very quick mashup of data, which is basically looking at an HTML table of a monopoly. So you can see some streets here, obviously, and the typical prices. We're going to parse that using the HTML type provider. And then essentially, we're going to merge that and mash that up with the land registry prices for the last month. And then we can see if that actually still makes sense or doesn't make sense. And if Mayfair is still the most expensive, if Old Kent Road is the cheapest. So there you can see we've got, for example, Euston Road is the most expensive one from the last month of prices. Now this is pretty simple though in terms of the amount of code we've had to write. We don't have to worry about distributing code to a cluster. We don't have to worry about sourcing data as such or parsing it. We can take some HTML tables, some CSV data, mash them up, send them across the cluster, do some analysis on it. Very, very easy.
Okay, so just to finish off, just to say Embrace is usable from C# as well. Here's a sample of using Embrace from C# Interactive. So you can, if you're into C#, you can do similar kinds of things, not with the full type provider experience, but you can do Embrace programming based on the same APIs. And to summarize, we're a bit short on time because of the snafus at the beginning. But just to say, F# as a language design has the right elements for the web and the cloud. I've covered those. The F# community is a wonderful place to cite your programming. It's fun, it's happy, creative, practical, really embraces innovation and imagination. And it has wonderful technologies. I've been through some of those. And so there's lots and lots of great things to get involved with. And come and join us and contribute to F#. And thanks very much for coming along.